Our story begins with a godlike being of immense power known only as the Emperor, uniting the warring factions of Earth and embarking on the Great Crusade to reunite all of mankind's lost colonies. He did this by creating 20 legions of post-human genetically engineered badasses known as Space Marines, each with an even more ridiculously OP Primarch to lead them. Unfortunately, the Four Gods of Chaos, who weren't really into that sort of thing, intervened and scattered the Primarchs across the universe while still in their infancy. Rather annoyed by this, the Emperor led the legions across the galaxy, reclaiming, subjugating, or annihilating every world they could find, gradually picking up the lost Primarchs along the way. Eventually, the Emperor decided there were more important things to do and retired from his career of galaxy plundering to go and muck about with ancient science back on Earth, leaving his favourite Primarch Horus in command of the Crusade. All was going well until the Chaos Tainted Chaplain Erebus engineered a plot in which Horus would also fall to Chaos. Already suffering from some pretty serious daddy issues, Horus gathered half the Space Marine Legions to his side and set about waging civil war against the Emperor. This conflict would be known as the Horus Heresy and culminated in a massive invasion of Earth. The Emperor, knowing his forces were outnumbered and on the verge of losing the battle, teleported to Horus' flagship to engage him in mortal combat. But being a sentimental old sod, could not bring himself to kill his favourite son. Horus, having no such qualms, beat the snot out of him. Finally seeing sense, the Emperor killed him with mind bullets and the Loyalists were victorious. Near death, the Emperor was placed in a huge machine known as the Golden Throne, which maintained its psychic essence at the bargain price of the souls of 1,000 unlucky sods every single day. The Imperium fell into a state of technological regression and brutal dictatorship, and for 10,000 years has been under siege from all sides by every single nasty the universe can throw at it. Basically, life sucks, there's only war, and you're probably gonna get eaten by tyrannids. Have fun.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition. 2, 1, 0, we have a liftoff. We have a liftoff and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Books in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico, and this is part two of our discussion with Josh Reynolds. Josh writes for the Black Library, among other things, and so he has written in the worlds of Warhammer and Warhammer 40,000. In part one, when we left off, Josh was just explaining to us the origin of the orcs. The orcs had always seemed to me, and we're not talking about Lord of the Rings orcs, we're talking about the Warhammer 40,000 sort of space orcs, had never seemed to me terribly interesting or original. But when Josh gives his explanation of sort of where they came from and what they're for, it's really fascinating, and I've become something more of not an enthusiast or a fan, but I find them much more interesting now than I did before Josh explained it. So he's going to go into that for a little bit, and then we'll cover every other remaining corner of the Warhammer and Warhammer 40,000 universes. So kick back and enjoy as we present part two of Josh Reynolds and the Warhammer 40,000 universe.
The orcs are, well, the orcs have an interesting origin in that they are the oldest alien species that man has had contact with.
Right.
So the first alien species that humanity fought were literally little green men.
Yeah.
Except the orcs aren't little or men.
Right.
They're basically green, big, giant, scarred up green gorillas.
Yeah.
And
with Cockney accents.
Yeah. Yeah, they sound like cockneys after a 6-week bender. But their origin is like the origin for the fantasy orcs, which is that nobody really knows what it is. They came from somewhere. They're a species that was clearly designed, like someone built the orcs.
Oh, okay. Now that I did not know.
In older versions of the Warhammer 40K universe, in older versions of the game, it's implied that the orcs were created to fight the Necrons. They were basically created as a a galactic antibody.
Oh, that's very interesting.
The orcs are a fungus-based life form, so wherever, even if you wipe out every orc on a planet, there's still a little patch of orc fungus somewhere on that planet that's going to spawn new orcs. and they grow knowing how to build every weapon they have. They know everything about their society, so one orc can propagate an entire, you know, war band of orcs that will be born aggressive and armed to the teeth.
Now, see, they're far more fascinating than I ever suspected, because all I've ever seen them used as was basically cannon fodder if the heroes needed to fight somebody, and it didn't need to be somebody with a very specific, you know, reason or right now.
Well, that is the point of the orcs. The orcs exist they fight everyone, and they don't care. They don't have a reason or rationale. They're just blindly aggressive.
Okay, that's
they're literally the universal immune system that's gone crazy. So they attack everything. Everything is a cancer.
So should the human empire have attacked them or fought them at all, or should they be left alone because they're doing something important?
Well, that's the thing, is they regard humans as just, you know, humans are just as easy a target as an Eldar craft world.
Oh, okay.
Or a bunch of chaos, you know, marines floating around out in space.
Yeah.
You know, the orcs are basically dangerous regardless. You know, nobody knows their origins. Their origins may have changed since that last time.
Mm-hmm.
They're essentially something that has always existed and always will exist regardless of who wins. Even if chaos wipes out humanity, the orcs will still exist to fight chaos. even if the Tyranids devour the galaxy, the orcs will still exist in the Tyranid bioships fighting Tyranids.
that's fascinating. Okay.
That's the Eldar. There's actually in one of the Eldar rule books, there was a great sequence where an Eldar Farseer basically says the orcs are the only winners the galaxy has. Because even when they lose a battle, they win. Because they got a fight. And after every race has burned out and died and collapsed, after every civilization has turned to ash, orcs will still be beating each other over the head with rocks in the ashes. And still be getting what they want. How can you not love that? How can you not love that?
They're kind of the cockroaches of the galaxy in a way, aren't they?
Basically, yes. They're something that exists solely to fight. And you can't, even when you lose a game, basically the orc rule book, when I was a kid, I had the orc rule book, I played with the orcs. You know, that's because you had big green guys with big green guns. Yeah. And it says in the orc rule book that even when you lose a game, you win. Because all the orcs want to do is fight. It doesn't matter whether they survive.
There you go.
So, if you're a person who has bad luck with dice rolls, like me, that makes you feel really good.
It's encouraging. Well, it is. Well, the other ones, I guess. I mean, there were dwarves for a while in the fourth.
Yeah, we don't talk about that.
Yeah, we kind of pretend they never happened, right?
Yeah.
There were some sort of little hobbit characters, but they've kind of.
They're still around.
Okay.
They are considered abhumans, like the Ogryn.
Okay.
Which are the ratlings are the hobbit. The halflings, excuse me, halflings. Can't call them hobbits.
Yeah, exactly.
The ratlings are humans born on high gravity worlds.
Oh.
Or, so they're shorter and stouter. I guess that's how that works.
Okay.
And then the Ogryn are ogres. They're big humans born on heavy gravity worlds with dense bone structure. They're not very smart.
Right.
They're muscly and big. And they exist as part of the Imperial Guard.
Right. Okay. We talked about the Eldar, basically space elves. There's the Dark Eldar, which are kind of dark elves, right?
Yes. It's the, in the fantasy universe, the elves and the dark elves are basically, and it's also the same for 40K. They're essentially the same race divided by not species, but by political affiliation.
Right.
The Eldar are a dying race. They're a race that exists only on craft worlds, which are immense bio-organic spaceships.
Mm-hmm.
And these spaceships are worlds. And the Eldar exist on these spaceships and are attempting to guide their race towards some unknown goal. and they live lives of kind of denial. To go back, the Eldar race in 40K were broken apart by the awakening of a chaos power. They had a Sodom and Gomorrah moment.
Yeah.
Where their hedonism, their entire species devolved to a point, became so decadent,
yeah,
that they created their own destroyer. They created a psychic entity which literally drove half of their species insane.
And that's one of the big chaos demon gods, right? It's, which one is that?
Yeah. It is Slaanesh.
Slaanesh, okay.
Or Slaanesh. Yeah, it's the god of pleasure, the prince of pleasure, or the god of hedonism, you know, lust.
That's the one that the Emperor's children like, is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's the one the Emperor's children have.
Fulgrim's patron, I guess.
Yeah, pretty much. They're also known among some fans as the god of orgies.
Yeah.
Which is not a family-friendly term, right. But the Eldar were shattered by the creation of this god, and the ones who didn't go mad, the ones who didn't, you know, descend into ravening beasts, fled. They fled in these craft worlds, and some of them, the Dark Eldar, basically they decided the best way to fight Slaanesh or to keep Slaanesh from devouring their species was to feed it something else. So they feed it the souls of slaves, of other Eldar, of anything they can capture. They basically keep Slaanesh, you know, quiet by feeding him souls. And the craft world Eldar, the Eldar, are attempting to stamp out chaos wherever they find it. So they're fighting.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to the Dark Eldar, who are kind of going, let's throw some Christians to the lions and hope the lions don't.
And humans should see the Eldar then as sort of natural allies, but they just don't like them, right? I mean, there's just this sense among the human empire that if it's alien in any way, it's just nasty and evil and has to be destroyed. That's the sense I get.
Well, that is true, but it's also that the Eldar will happily sacrifice 100 human worlds to spare the life of one Eldar.
Yeah.
So the Eldar see humans as pieces on a board. So the humans are a weapon,
right?
That they can employ, or sometimes a weapon that's turned against them that they have to destroy.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no real sense of camaraderie there. There's no because aliens are alien, because they think alien thoughts and do not have a comparable viewpoint with humans. Humans and aliens can never really be allies.
Yeah, that's the impression.
They're allies of convenience as opposed to fast friends.
Right. The other two we'd mentioned, I think, a little bit in passing. If you like more like the pure technological alien race, there's the Tau.
Yes.
They seem interesting to me.
They're the only good guys in the universe.
Well, yeah. In fact, what I've gotten the impression is that in the last couple of years, they've gone back and rewritten the backstory or the rules about the Tau because they were too likable. Is that?
Yes. Pretty much.
I mean, they look like little Iron Man. They got little armor like Iron Man and guns, and they got these really cool floating tanks and hovercraft and everything. I mean, if you like Iron Man, if you like you know, the high tech look, they very clean and crisp. The Tau are awesome.
I mean, if you like Japanese, you know, if you like Japanese cartoons,
yeah,
there's the Tau.
There you go.
They're essentially a species that is on the rise. Where in most science fiction, if humanity is meeting aliens, humanity is sort of climbing the ladder. And, you know, humans are slowly starting to gain space travel and slowly starting to do this in most science fiction.
Right.
Well, in 40K, humans are on the downward slide.
Right.
They've discovered everything they're ever going to discover. You know, they're not going to make any new discoveries.
And they've lost a lot of what they found in the past, too, which is kind of a neat thing.
And the Tau are on the rise. The Tau are the young race, the new race, that's just discovered that there is a wider universe out there that wants to kill them. And so they, you know, and they're trying to bring a peaceful hegemony to the galaxy. The Tau'ser, the greater good.
Yeah.
Which sounds really nice until you actually explore it and realize what the greater good actually means is everybody do what the Tau say. And you're fine.
Hey, that's something I hadn't really touched on before that you just mentioned there that I want to that we were talking about there, that I think is important, is that people need to understand there was some sort of an event, even before the Horus Heresy, right, that caused, in other words, we are to understand that even before the rise of the Emperor, and tell me if I'm wrong here, but even before the rise of the Emperor in the 30,000-year period, humans rose to an even greater height and spread out across the universe, almost like in Dune. In fact, I think there's a lot of Dune in this.
Yes, there is.
And then something happened, and they lost touch with a lot of those colony worlds all across the galaxy, the universe, or whatever. And yes. They lost the understanding of a lot of their technology. So what you see in Warhammer 40,000 in particular is that, and I think this is really important to understand the flavor of this universe, of the fiction and the game. Again, I don't care anything about the game, but I am interested in talking about it in how it serves the story, is that you have to understand that what the humans are using, you've mentioned several times that the humans have kind of done everything, you know, they've done as much as they can, they've been as great as they can be, and they're on the downward slide. And I think that people have to understand they're still fighting, they're using what they have left, but they don't really understand it, and they've made a lot of it religious. In other words, they've got these giant Titan robots, they're like Shogun warriors that they use, and that's awesome. But they don't really understand them, and they don't really know how they work. And there's almost a kind of a supernatural element to them, and they rely on these. They rely on these sort of priests as much as mechanics to keep them going.
Yeah, well, they don't actually have any mechanics. They just have the machine priests.
Yeah.
if you're a mechanic. If you're not just, like, you're not allowed to fix anything. The machine priests have to fix everything. If you know how to fix something, they will find you and kill you.
Good gosh. I didn't know about that.
Yes. Yes, it's actually a plot point in a couple of the books that somebody has to hide knowing how to fix a machine. Because the machine priests, the worshippers of the machine god, will find you and either induct you forcibly or kill you.
Yeah, it's almost like the... after the Butlerian Jihad in Dune,
yes.
Where things are religiously proscribed and only along certain religious lines can they be used or done. And so, yeah, I mean, it makes it for a very interesting story point that I think that in a lot of these books, a lot of these stories, that the technology is so limited. The technology is on the one hand almost limitless, but on the other hand very limited. Because they can only use what they already have, and they don't even understand it.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. So so you get almost like a World War I level technology in some battles, because that's all they have to work with, and that's all they really know how to use in some cases.
Yeah. Most of the technology they have comes either something they remembered and kept working, since the Horus Heresy, since the 30Ks, or it's something they found from the standard technology templates.
Yeah.
Or it's these templates that are scattered throughout the galaxy before humanity fell, before the Emperor rose to power. There's these things where basically people, almost like a Star Trek replicator, it's something where they put the plans and designs for this, you know, a colony's water source. Or the plans and designs for a different type of gun, or the plans and designs for, you know, an air conditioner, onto this little template, this little data slate, and the Empire will wage whole wars just to get a data slate that tells them how to fix the coffee maker.
That's right. Yeah, I believe wasn't that like the plot of the first Gaunt's Ghost book was something about they'd found a template for building robots or something like that.
Yes, the Iron Men.
Yeah,
yeah, that was either the first or the second one, and that's one of the ones that kind of explains why there are no actual robots around.
Yeah,
because they're intelligent and nobody wants that running around.
Yeah, again, very Dune influence in that way. The thinking machines. Yeah,
although the Titans and stuff do think, they do have a mind.
Yeah,
the ships, the the starships that the Empire uses do have a machine spirit, and which is like an artificial intelligence.
And that's why they're very carefully regulated and have like a priesthood that controls them or interacts with them, I guess, and all that.
Yes. And there's actually a very good sequence in Throne of Lies, which is an audio book or an audio play by Aaron Dembski Bowden.
Yeah.
Where the navigator for the Chaos ship is having to literally argue with the machine spirit for the ship she's on to keep it from killing them all. Because it wants to do something that will kill everybody on the ship.
Yeah.
And she's having to kind of, it's like wrangling an intelligent tiger.
Yeah.
And getting it to do what you want.
Yeah.
Which I thought was, it's very interesting.
That is very, very interesting. Cool. The other alien race I want to mention, we mentioned the Necrons, I guess I'm pronouncing it right, from like Necronomicon or Necropolis, anything to do with death. They are interesting. They came along the last 5 or 10 years, I guess. They are kind of like the Terminator, right? But with a sort of a supernatural thing, Egyptian almost thing going on.
Yeah. The Necrons are the last vestiges of the Necron tier. The Necron tier were one of the first races in the galaxy alongside the Eldar. The Necron tier were actually the rivals, if I remember my background correctly. The Necron tier were the rivals of the race that created the Eldar and the Orcs.
Okay.
So there was a previous race called the Old Ones, who the Eldar were kind of like their first attempt at making life. And they were rivaled by the Necron tier, who were, you know, an old dying empire. And the Necrons essentially sealed themselves into robotic bodies in order to preserve their lives during this war they had with the Old Ones and with some other species that the Necrons served and then killed.
Mm.
That are these very powerful star-eating entities that the Necron tier served as gods and then kind of said no and killed them all. And then, you know, they're slowly waking up. Now in the 40K universe, the Necrons are slowly, their cities, they're these massive tomb cities under planets, you know, planets that have been settled by humans for 15,000-16,000 years.
Yeah.
And the Necron cities are way below the surface of the Earth, and they're starting to rise to the top of the Earth and unleash these sleeping dead. This sleeping dead civilization is waking back up and going, what are all these little monkeys doing around?
just one more thing to kill humans, basically.
Yeah, it's interesting. If you the newest incarnation of the Necrons are very interesting because they're less the Terminator and more RoboCop, I guess.
Mm.
They're a species that's used to be alive, and they remember being alive, and it's kind of driven them crazy. So they do things as if they're still alive.
Mm-hmm.
So the kings, the lords of the Necrons still have balls, and they still try and eat food, and they still, you know, plot and scheme with each other, even though there's no real gain to it.
Right.
So it's kind of cool.
And this is what I mean by saying it's almost like the Marvel universe of science fiction, is that you get so many different things like that. I mean, that by itself could be a dozen novels or something, you know, but yet that's just one small corner of this universe. So it's really, really cool. Well, in our last little segment here, I just wanted to kind of run through some things. Like I said, I think it's gotten more sophisticated over the last 10 or 15 years. I like that it really gives you kind of a little horror, a little science fiction horror. It's not just pure, clean science fiction. It has kind of that supernatural kind of horror element to it that you get with like an Alien movie, you know, or like I said, Event Horizon or something like that, Prometheus, you know. It's got that kind of a cool science fiction, but also you're scared to death, here comes the evil monster going to eat us type thing. So,
yeah.
And it's gradually being introduced, like I said, into the literature. I mean, there was like one scene in one of the Ravenor books, which is a 40,000 series by Dan Abnett, where they go accidentally into the future and see the Tyranids?
Yes.
And they don't name them that. They don't know what they are. But when I'm reading, I'm going, hey, we're finally getting those guys. Finally, you know, so I thought that was really neat.
The Tyranids do make quite a few appearances in the Caiaphas Kane
books. Oh, okay, okay.
By Sandy Mitchell, and they are terrifying.
Yeah. They are basically like the aliens from Aliens. And that's what's kind of, to some degree, that's what's neat. I mean, if it's a sci-fi menace and you like it, there's probably something analogous to it in Warhammer 40,000.
Pretty much.
If you like the cyborg skull face Terminator killing machines, you got the Necrons. I never call them Necrons because that sounds like a red Necron, and then they're suddenly driving pickup trucks and throwing beer cans out the window. But anyway, you know, if you like the aliens, these ravenous, mindless alien, you know, then you got the Tyranids. You know, if you like more the cerebral, you know, you've got the Eldar or the Dark Eldar. If you like you know, the armored technology guys, you got the Tau. There's just something for everybody there, really. It's amazing.
Yeah. It's a game, and it's meant to appeal to the broadest base. So you have to have a little something for everybody.
And they've done that.
Even though, you know, most people still just play Space Marines.
Oh, gosh, that's funny.
Getting back to those earliest stages, the reason that the Horus Heresy was invented was so that they could sell a game that had nothing but Space Marines in it.
Yeah, well, and we got to point out, too, though, that if you, even within the Space Marines, the Astartes, or however you pronounce that, the Adeptus Astartes, they have, like, many different chapters and legions and whatnot, and so there's lots of different personalities and characters and appearances and colorful, you know, even within just that one sort of, they call it like army or whatever, but even within that one sort of element of the universe, there's a lot of diversity, right?
Oh, yes. There's in the 40K universe, there are 1,000 legions, 1,000 chapters of Space Marines.
Hmm.
And in the 30K universe, there are only
20 legions, right? Or 18.
Yeah, there's 18 legions because we don't talk about the other two.
For some unknown reason, we're not allowed to talk about or don't look over there. Don't look at that. Yeah. Them don't.
They were wiped out. Nobody asks why.
Don't ask. Yeah, the Emperor comes. The Emperor will appear in your house and just like smite you if you even like ask the question. So it's, you know, it's funny to me. The first thing I thought of when I ran into that there were two legions that they've been erased from the records and you don't even ask about them, is it makes me think of Roger Zelazny's Amber Princes. When you start discovering that beyond the nine that exist now, there were some earlier brothers and sisters that are mostly dead or missing, and you just don't ask about them because he's dead and he never wrote anything about them. So, you know, you'll just never know what happened to those earlier ones. And it's kind of the same way. These armies just disappeared or something bad has happened and the Emperor doesn't like to acknowledge them.
Well, you know, the Space Wolves ate them or something.
Yeah. Well, just Space Wolves. Yeah. And that's another thing, too, is from the different perspectives. Like, if you read, and this is something I was going to talk about, we've got to mention these two in particular, two books in the Horus Heresy series. There's 1,000 Sons that Graham McNeil did, which was a New York Times bestseller, with, I think, just the most awesome, spectacular cover art ever. I just love the cover of that book. It's those Egyptian-looking troops. Of
Thousand Sons.
Magnus's Thousand Sons, in front of their pyramid buildings. And then in that book, Graham does I was going to mention this anyway, and I know you may not even want to address this at all, and I totally understand that, but let me just put this out here for my listeners. Graham McNeil is one of the top, I would say, writers in the Black Library. From a technical standpoint, his skill at like describing scenes and just the language he uses is almost unmatched. He just amazes me at his writing ability when it comes to just colorful turns of phrase and all that. The one problem I have with Graham McNeil's writing is that he to me, and again, you don't even have to go there because I know you don't want to probably say anything negative against your fellow guys, and that totally everybody understands that. But just for me, and I'm curious what the listeners think if they're into this, is that one of the important things about writing is also being able to maintain dramatic tension from chapter to chapter and give you a propulsion through the pages, a momentum. And sometimes with Graham, I feel so bogged down in his descriptions that I don't feel any, it kind of loses the momentum to move forward. So if there's, so I'll just leave it this. If there's one, Graham, I'm sure you listen to our show.
I'm sure he is listening and drinking whatever god-awful sized bottle of alcohol he uses to get through every day.
Yes, yes. And feverishly taking notes, right? I would say this, Graham. You are you're an amazing writer, and A Thousand Suns in particular was fantastic. And you're an award-winning writer, so others believe the same thing. But just if you could just find a way to kind of give us like some cliffhangers at the end of chapters, or give us some sense of, ooh, I got to find out what happens next. Just a little something to keep us turning the pages would be great. Okay, thanks. Now,
Oh, God, he's going to beat the crap out of me.
No. A brilliant writer, though. Absolutely brilliant writer.
Yes. All right. Well, I mean, every writer who is on the Horus Heresy series is the top writer. Those writers are the cream of the Black Library crop.
Well, so except for... See, I probably shouldn't even...
You're allowed to have opinions.
I'll put it this way. The opening trilogy started with one of the most brilliant science fiction books I've ever read. I love Horus Rising. I've got it on audio. I've read it three times. I listen to it every now and then. I just think it's brilliant. False Gods, Graham McNeil did the second one. He does what he does very well there, which is you're given a story and he'll lay it out for you in beautiful language. And then there was that third one, which I'm just reading it and going, seriously. I mean, they could have called me and I could have done a serviceable job and it was such a great title. It's got like the most important events, and it's like a play by play of a football game or something. I don't know. It's just, wow. You're not,
it's, you know, there are some authors who are going to be like Marmite, and they're, if you know what Marmite is.
No.
Marmite is a horrible, salty spread that you put on toast or whatever.
Okay.
That the British love it.
Okay.
So some of them love it, but Marmite is, some people love it, some people hate it.
There you go.
And that's how some authors are.
That's absolutely fair. That's absolutely fair. Yeah. And I apologize to Josh in front of everybody because I drag him on the show here and then put him in an uncomfortable position. But I just felt like that's something that I've felt very strongly about, and I kind of wanted to state is that some of them are better than others. But I do agree that for the most part, the Horus Heresy stuff is spectacular and spectacularly well written. And I'm looking forward to when you get to crank those things out.
That is never going to happen.
Please. I'm sure they're drawing up plans even now.
But that would be nice, but no.
Well, in my, as I was originally saying though, before I sidetracked both of us, and I'm sorry.
That's right.
Yeah. In A Thousand Suns, Graham puts out you're so sympathetic to the Thousand Suns. You see all the bad stuff that happens to them, but you see why it happens. It's all a big misunderstanding. They're really good guys. They mean well. Doggone it, why this happened to them. And those nasty, crappy, mean old space wolves come along and just blindly serve the Emperor and do the bad thing that they're supposed to do, and you just hate them. That was my only experience with the wolves up to that point. And I was just like, oh, I hate them. Then you read Prospero Burns.
Yeah.
And they're like a bunch of like Thor's buddies hanging out in the break room, drinking jet fuel and composing poems and stuff.
Yeah.
And so it's just fascinating how you get a different perspective from two very good writers, and it can shift you. It's almost like reading chapters of George R. R. Martin's, the Game of Thrones books, where one chapter you just hate Jaime Lannister and wish him dead, and the next chapter you're like, wow, he's a pretty cool guy. Why did I ever think that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the point of a series like The Horus Heresy, is to show you that the guys that you've always traditionally thought of as being evil might not necessarily be as bad as the Imperium of Man, as the Empire would like you to believe.
Right.
The word bearers in particular are just sad.
Yeah.
Like, I find them just not pathetic, but just I find everything about them just very sad, because they're guys who really tried their best and really had, you know, they had a devotion and a loyalty to the Emperor second to none, mm-hmm. and then they're treated kind of crappily and things fall apart.
And then that book makes you talk about Aaron Dembski Bowden's the First Heretic.
Yes.
It tells that story. And in that one, you hate the Ultramarines. And then you,
oh, God, yes.
And then you go and read Abnett's
No Fear.
No Fear, the Battle of Kalth. And you're like, whoa, the Ultramarines are really cool.
Yes.
So it really is amazing how you see the different perspectives and the different sides of these armies and their leaders, you know. And you can go from hating them to loving them just because of how they're portrayed from one book to the next. It's amazing.
And I mean, every writer has a chapter, a legion that they seem to have really gotten their hooks into, and know how to show you the best. Like Dan Abnett is amazing. Well, Dan Abnett's just amazing. All of them. But let's just say that. But he's, you know, the Ultramarines. You know, the Ultramarines are kind of the vanilla Marine. Like they're in terms of the game, they're the standard Marine.
Yeah.
Because every, you know, the Ultramarines are, they set the standard. They're what a Space Marine should be.
Right.
And they've never really seemed to have any character. And then you read something like No Fear, and you realize that, oh, hey, they have a lot of character.
Yeah.
Like, there's a reason they're the standard. There's a reason they're the best.
Yeah.
And here is that reason. And the Space Wolves, you know, Space Vikings. Who doesn't like Space Vikings?
And that's what they are, basically, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's neat how Abnett kind of gives them more depth, right? They're not just that. He gives them all kinds of sort of, I don't know the word I would use, but a lot of background and depth to them that makes them, using a lot of sort of Norse kind of terminology.
Yeah, and he's adding a lot of flavor.
Yeah.
As our mutual friend Derek Ferguson says.
Yes.
He adds a lot of bits of business to the character, you know. So it's just these little bits that you can sink your teeth into, and that show you kind of that one little word, that one little phrase, kind of says, oh, now I get it. Right. Now I know what these guys do.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of the Ultramarines, as we move into our very last segment here before we run out of time, I was going to talk about in other media, and the Ultramarines were the subject of an entirely CGI movie in the last couple of years, and
yes.
I really enjoyed it. I thought they did a pretty darn good job with it. What did you think?
I actually just recently saw it myself,
mm-hmm.
and I quite enjoyed it. You know, it's a Marmite thing. It's a lot of people really enjoyed it, and some people really didn't. And apparently there were issues with how it was portrayed and how it was written and set up and everything. Dan Abnett actually wrote it.
Yeah.
It was interesting. It was an interesting first foray. I will say that.
Yeah.
It was something that shows what can be done with the setting and the intellectual property that I don't think people really expected. Like, you know, you say a movie and people immediately think, oh, well, you know, actors and sets. And this was something that was like, nope, we could just do a CGI, you know, not quite a cartoon.
Yeah, exactly. It was basically a cartoon with mostly action and just some character stuff kind of all through it to hold it together. But I thought it was very effective in that way.
Yes.
If you go in expecting it to be that, then you get a great version of that.
Well, I mean, 40K and fantasy both, I've told people this before, and you know, people kind of shoo me off when I say it, but they're pulp stories.
Yeah.
They are old school science fiction and fantasy pulp.
Yeah.
And the movie was the same way. It's a pulp story. It's this little burst of action and bombast, and you know, it was good. I would like to see them do more, frankly.
Yeah.
I would like to see some, you know, every Space Marine Battles book, you know, every all the books that detail just one battle with a Space Marine chapter fighting somebody.
Yeah.
It's a whole series of books, and each of those would make a great movie.
Oh, and I think the Horus Heresy would make like a Star Wars level 6 movie, 9 movie epic. I mean, that just would be fantastic.
Oh, yes. That would be
spectacular.
Yeah. makes me sad. We'll probably never see that.
I know. Well, but the way it's going, though, and that's something else I was going to touch on, is that it seems to be growing at such a pace now that I don't put anything past it in the future. I mean, who would have thought we would get the Avengers and Iron Man 3, you know, back in the 60s and 70s with Marvel?
Well, I will tell you that, you know, this weekend, this weekend where we're recording this, is the Horse Heresy Weekender.
Yeah.
So right now on Twitter, I am reading a Twitter feed right now where people are talking about how much fun they're having at the Horse Heresy Weekend.
Which is like a little mini convention for that stuff, right?
Yeah, just for the Horse Heresy stuff.
So they'll have some of the authors there, and they have a whole bunch of books for sale and audio dramas. And
they're releasing the new miniatures, because the Forge World, which is a division of Games Workshop, is releasing rules and miniatures specifically for you to fight the game in the Horse Heresy.
Wow. Yeah.
So there are models of all the characters, Erebus, Corpharon, all the Primarchs get miniatures, and it's just like, oh my God.
See, I just love the idea that this one little property, even a subdivision of a subdivision of a game of a company, has its own convention now. I mean, that's got to be very encouraging that it's happening.
And it's sold out. It's sold out.
Yeah. You can go on YouTube and see like last year's version.
Yes.
And you can,
which I was at, by the way.
And you can see people from the U.S. and Britain in it, and you can see, you know, how cool it all looks and everything. It's just very inspiring to me to think that this kind of stuff could be, you know, grow up around a cool property like this.
Well, it wasn't even just people from the U.S. and Britain. It was people from, you know, it was people from Saudi Arabia. Yeah. It was people from South Africa. There are people from all over the world that are fans of the Horus Heresy. They're fans of 40K. And going to a convention like that and sitting down and having somebody come up and want you to sign their book, and it's somebody from, you know, Portugal.
Yeah.
you know, Czechoslovakia or somewhere, and he's going, it just puts you at a loss for words.
Yeah. Really. Well, you know, as we move toward our ending, and I mentioned the other media, they are doing audio books of these now. They're doing audio dramas, which are like old school radio dramas, right?
Yeah.
We got that movie.
Full cast. Yeah.
So it's slowly creeping into other forms of media. That's pretty cool, I think.
It is. Games Workshop actually, I think, just opened their own audio studio.
Wow.
Because up till now, they've been doing the audio plays and the audio books out of house.
Right.
They've been, you know, doing it with like Big Finish and places like that. And now they've got their own studio because they it's doing so well. They're like, hey, let's just open our own studio.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, who knows what's coming next.
So my last sort of series of questions to you then. The future of all of this, where do you think it might all be going, just in terms of the overall Black Library itself, Warhammer 40,000? I don't necessarily mean specific within stories, but where do you see all this going? What can we kind of see coming in the future?
In specific, I am relatively certain that the Horus Heresy is, in terms of the books, is just the beginning of something bigger.
Wow.
I believe that there are, don't quote me,
okay,
but I'm going to say this on this podcast, which is listened to by literally millions of people.
Yeah. Oh, you've read our propaganda. Good. Okay.
I have. I made sure to check up on that. That there are plans to undertake the scouring, for instance, which is what happens when, after the, you know, during the Horus Heresy, the beginning stage of the Horus Heresy, humanity kicks the crap out of every alien species.
Yeah.
And then the scouring is when the Chaos Legion, you know, the legions that betrayed the Emperor, are fleeing into the Eye of Terror, and the Space Marines are hunting them. And it's also when every alien species turns around and says, hey, guess what? We're coming back. And it's just this period of tumultuous upheaval. And it's kind of like the beginning of the slide, if you will.
Right.
But Horus Heresy is where the Empire of Man goes off the edge.
Yeah.
And then the scouring is the period where they're sliding down the hill.
Well, you know, I've got to tell you, and think, that's awesome. I think that would make logical sense. I got to tell you, I think that I find the Horus Heresy period, the 30,000 period, much more interesting and compelling than the 40,000. I always read the 40,000 stuff for the last 10 or 12 years, and I enjoyed it. But it seems almost sort of like the tail end. It seems like it's not really necessarily going anywhere. It's interesting and it's good, and I look forward to new stuff in it. But the 30,000 stuff just seems so much more epic and big and bold and
that's the point of it.
Yeah,
it's the grand unifying mythology of the 40K universe. This is the period when gods and heroes walked among the stars and fought each other.
Right.
You know, this is the fall of Olympus. You know, it's the Book of Revelation. It's, you know, Ragnarok.
Yeah, I guess 40,000 almost seems kind of like kicking around in the ashes. And what we're seeing here is the inferno.
Exactly. Yeah, 40K is the ashes. It's the ashes of empires. What happens after the Roman Empire falls?
Yeah, yeah. And this
it has its interesting stories. But, you know, the Horus Heresy, the buildup, where you get to see all these legendary characters.
And the legions. I mean, like you say, if it's the Roman Empire, this is where you see the giant legions marching out over the world and conquering and all.
In 40K, the Space Marine chapters are but pale shadows of the Space Marine legions.
Yeah, much smaller and rare.
But, like, it's one of the things from the Horus Heresy Weekend or just now was Dan Abnett saying that, followed it on Twitter, of course, like a good Black Library author, is Dan Abnett saying that the size of the Ultramarines Legion in 30K is the same, is there are as many Ultramarines in 30K as there are Space Marines in 40K.
Yeah, right. So it's so
there's millions.
Yeah, they've shrunk down that much, I guess, is the thing, yeah.
Well, in the aftermath of the Horus Heresy, the Space Marine legions are shattered. They're broken up into chapters. So 1,000 Marines in 1,000 chapters.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, 1 million Marines.
There you go.
But in 30K, there's 1 million Ultramarines. There's 1 million Space Wolves.
Yeah, it's just amazing.
Just those numbers are staggering. There's numbers of men fighting and dying on battleships, on spacecraft, the size of planets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a great sequence, the Void Warfare sequence in No Fear.
Yeah.
Is where they're fighting on the outside of the ship.
Yes.
You know, it's on the cover. It's on the cover where they're fighting on the outside
That's
of the
right.
ship.
That's right.
And it's just like, you know, it's hundreds of thousands of men climbing across this battleship, fighting each other in the void of space.
Yeah. And yet, by the way, since you mentioned that, the covers, they got one artist. Is it Neil Roberts? Is that who it is?
It's Neil Roberts, who is an awesome dude,
oh my
by the way.
Goodness, the cover art. And I mean,
he's doing a comic. They're doing a comic.
Oh no.
Neil Roberts is drawing a comic written by Dan Abnett.
Oh my,
that takes
God.
Between No Fear and next Ultramarines book.
Oh my goodness.
And it is, I have seen some of the pages, it is spectacular.
My goodness. Yeah, that's the thing, is that they were putting them out originally just in these little mass market small paperbacks, and the trade dress, as classy and neat as it is, covers up a lot of the art. And so it was very frustrating to see that there was this great cover art that was shrunk down to like 6 inches tall and covered up with big black boxes.
at the conventions, at the Black Library Weekender last year, and the Horus Heresy Weekender this year and Black Library Weekender this year, you can actually buy full-size posters of that art. It's things that are the size of a wall in your house.
Yeah.
Just huge. And there's just the images from those covers. It's just the images, full, you know, the full image.
Well, and what they've been doing with the trade dress now is that they're putting the Horus Heresy books out in a bigger format, like a big trade paperback, and with gatefold covers, so that you can actually lay the book open and see a much larger representation. They need to do 1,000 Suns that way. I would snap that sucker up. I'd buy another copy just to have a big copy of it, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so good, so nice.
There's so many little details. And it's just, you could stare at them. I literally stared at the cover for one of the Horus Heresy books. It might have been 1,000 Suns. I stared at it for like 20 minutes, just picking out the little details he put in.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and when I started doing my own series kind of in this same vein, I had to find a cover artist for the Omnibus collection that will eventually come out. And I got M.D. Jackson from our Pulp Factory group.
Yeah.
Who's very good. And he did me a cover, which I'll be springing on the public and hopefully in about a few months to a year that kind of evokes that same sort of sense. It was hard to find somebody that could do something like that. That's a pretty...
If anybody can do that, it's M.D. Jackson.
Yeah, absolutely. And he did. I'm very pleased. So my last question for you then, before we wrap up, What would you kind of like to be doing? What is your kind of your hope for the future of working with Black Library? Where do you kind of want to go with it? And then tell us kind of what you're doing now that we should look for, too.
Well, I'll approach that in a backwards fashion.
Okay.
what I'm doing right now is I'm actually one of the authors on the Gottschalk and Felix series.
Yeah.
Which is the longest running fantasy series.
Mm-hmm.
Which is essentially it's about a crazy dwarf, crazy suicidal dwarf warrior, and the guy he's strong armed into writing his final epic battle as they wander across the world seeking a good death for this dwarf, and they end up surviving every single thing that they run through. And I'm one of the authors on that.
Mm-hmm.
The book right now is out right now. It's called Gottschalk and Felix, Road of Skulls, which it would please me to no end if everybody picked up a copy.
Heck yes.
Because it's good. It's fun. Nope. It's got a lot of fighting. It's 100,000 words of adrenaline combat.
There you go.
I'm also working on the Time of Legends series called The Blood of Nagash, which is essentially sword and sorcery vampires.
Mm-hmm. That's where they're doing sort of a Horus Heresy for the fantasy world, which is called Time of Legends, right?
Yes. Time of Legends it's a little more spaced out. The Horus Heresy is one big event where everything is connected.
Yeah.
And the Time of Legends are usually multiple events happening at the same time or within 100 years of each other. And several of the Time of Legends series, for instance, are about elves and dwarves, the war between the elves and dwarves. C.L. Werner, Clint Werner, is doing one about the Black Plague in the Empire.
I love that.
Which is, well, it's the interesting, because it's the first time that the humans in the fantasy world have come up against the Skaven, who are this under-empire of crazy ratmen. And it is a beautiful thing to read. And I'm doing the vampires, which Leap is kind of a follow-up to Mike Lee's Rise of Nagash series.
Right.
And it's essentially, if you're a fan of bloody, nasty, treacherous, monstrous vampires, you should buy that book. you should really buy it.
So noted.
Yeah. If you don't like Twilight, buy Neferata, Blood of Nagash, because it's pretty much the antidote.
That's awesome. You couldn't say it better.
As to what I would like to work on, well, there are numerous things in fantasy I would like to work on. Strangely enough, I'm not a fantasy reader, but I like writing it.
Huh, that's interesting.
So, yeah. I would, of course, love to work on anything having to do with 40K, just from a sheer, nasty, mercenary part of my soul. Because anything with a Space Marine on the cover apparently sells tremendously well. And Daddy needs him some of that Space Marine money. I got a mortgage. It's, you know, there's literally so... The IP, the intellectual property that Games Workshop and Black Library have a hold of is so epic,
yeah,
and so vast. I could literally talk for hours on end about what I want to write.
And our show could go on for hours about it too, but
yes.
I'm afraid we are nearing our conclusion. So are there any last thoughts you have before we wrap up for today?
Yes. One of my last thoughts would be everyone should go out and buy the first three books in the Horus Heresy series.
Yeah.
And I think everyone should check out the books of the authors writing for the Horus Heresy series.
Yeah.
Because tie-in fiction gets a bad rap. Wholly unjustified. But if you like pulp fiction, and if you're listening to this podcast, you probably do.
Yeah.
If you like pulp fiction, that's what Black Library is selling. They're selling some of the best modern pulp fiction that is out now. And you would do yourself a favor by checking it out.
If you like science fiction and horror to some degree, if you like military science fiction, if you like action, pulp, like you say, it's all in there. And you can find an author, even if you don't like all of it, you can find an author or two that really appeals to you. It may well be Josh. I mean, I'm going to go snap up all his stuff immediately.
as you should.
Absolutely. So yeah, I totally recommend it. It's fantastic, and it's also diverse. You know, you could read three different books and get a completely different experience from even within Warhammer 40,000 or even within the Horus Heresy. You know, so
yes, I mean it's reading books like, you know, you follow the main storyline, but you can also pick up books like Nemesis, for instance, by Jim Swallow, which is nothing but assassins. It doesn't have there are no Space Marines in it. It's assassins going on an assassination mission. And it's great.
Yeah.
And there's stuff like that. Something for everyone.
And I would wrap up myself by saying that, as a quick little plug of my own, since it's my show and I can do it, is that I'm sort of trying to do my own take on this sort of an approach to pulp sci-fi military. And the first volume of that is Lords of Fire. If you want to hear an audio sample of part of that book, I believe episode 16 of this show, I did a kind of an audiobook special where I read like one or two chapters from it. So go back to, I think it was episode 16, audiobook special, Lords of Fire, or you can just buy it on Kindle or pick up the paperback.
I'm going to buy it on Kindle tonight.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, I'd appreciate it. Yeah, and that's the one that's it's going to be a three-part series, Lords of Fire, Sons of Terra, and Kings of Oblivion, and then we put the whole thing out someday in two or three years as a big, giant, fat paperback. It'll have that Jackson cover on it too, so I'm very excited about that. But it is sort of my take on sort of the Horus Heresy kind of approach to science fiction, so I'm curious to see what people think about that.
I'm sure they'll love it.
Well, I appreciate it.
Of course they'll love it.
Well, Josh, I appreciate you joining us all the way from the United Kingdom today. It must be like 3 o'clock in the morning there or something crazy now, so
it's 4:30 in the afternoon.
Close enough. So I'm afraid our time is up. We thank you for yours as always. It's time for the White Rocket to raise our void shields and dive back into the Eye of Terror. So we will see you all down the road. See you later, Josh.
See you later. Thanks for having me.
Griffin, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at esonetwork.com.